Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're not looking at a standard historical event or, a typical tragedy.
Yeah, not at all.
We are stepping into something else entirely. It's a chilling piece of Mexican folklore, a story that's so deeply rooted in this idea of extreme wealth and pathological control.
It's about obsession.
Exactly. The pursuit of a fortune became so consuming, so absolute, that it led to a literal generational self-consumption.
It's a perfect storm of human pathology and maybe something more.
It's a terrifying tale of family, fortune, and fire. But this is the strange part. It's a fire that locals, for generations now, have sworn made almost no sound at all.
The silent fire.
Okay, so let's really unpack this. We're diving into the legend of the silent fire of Juana Mansion. It's all anchored around a very specific, notorious location. This mansion on the outskirts of Juana, Montana, in
And
Mexico.
the people who live there.
The inhabitants, yeah. They made this horrifying generations-long pact, all in the name of purity.
But not a moral purity. We need to be very clear about that.
No, not at all. It had nothing to do with morality and, everything to do with capital. So our core mission today, for you, is to really analyze what happens when an obsession with money and bloodlines just completely overtakes the fundamental reality of being alive.
In this legend, while it ends up in this very supernatural place, it begins with something profoundly human, pathology.
Right?
Our sources here are really rich, they're fragmented, but that's what makes them so interesting. We have bits of local eyewitness accounts, historical rumors passed down for generations in that region,
And the police reports.
and yes, some really intriguing details that are alleged to be from the initial police reports right after the catastrophe. And all these sources that give us these key anchors, we can build a pretty precise timeline. We can track how this obsession evolves.
And what are we looking at fundamentally?
We're looking at a family that tried to, transcend mortality, not through any spiritual means, but by preserving their fortune and their specific surname at literally any cost. And that path, it inevitably leads to this profound physical and, you could argue, spiritual distortion.
The log line for this whole deep dive really just captures the horror of it perfectly.
It does.
A Mexican family so rich they married only each other until their mansion burned and the curse didn't.
That says it all.
It sets the stage for a conversation about how power, especially when it's held too tightly, just becomes a self-inflicted prison.
And the mission here for you, the learner, is razor sharp.
Yeah.
We need to analyze this legend of this unnamed wealthy family of Juana to understand the sociological and even the metaphysical consequences of obsession.
It's a case study.
It's a perfect case study. It's about what happens when a family decides that the external world is just too impure, too volatile, too risky to ever touch their wealth, their name, or their physical bloodline. And we have to start by looking at the architecture of their paranoia.
Exactly. So let's move into Act One, the architecture of obsession. We need to understand the who, the where, the when, and I think most importantly, the why. The why behind this monumental generational self-exile. And the story begins, like you said, with a very specific location, a mansion. A mansion standing starkly on the outskirts of Juana, Montana.
And that detail, the outskirts, is the first big clue, isn't it?
It's everything. It wasn't just designed to be a large, impressive home. It was engineered as a literal fortress against society.
That geographic distinction is immediately telling. They weren't just the wealthiest family in the town.
No.
They intentionally positioned themselves outside of it. It's a fundamental rejection of the community structure right from the start.
And the sources, they are emphatic about their status. They use terms like filthy rich, ultra wealthy. Their fortune was the stuff of local myth long before the fire ever happened.
But what's key here, and what the sources keep coming back to, is the functional role of that money. It wasn't just a resource for them to use. It became the sacred foundation of their entire identity. It dictated every single action they took.
It's like the money was a living thing.
A living, breathing entity that they had to serve, not the other way around.
And this service, it led directly to their defining motivation. The source material spells out this truly absolute, all-consuming
It
obsession.
was a twofold commitment.
Yeah, exactly. They were terrified of, quote, not losing their fortune. And, crucially, just as obsessed with keeping their specific surname intact and pure.
They saw wealth and the name as intrinsically linked. You couldn't separate them. They were two parts of the same sacred entity that had to be protected from, from entropy. From dilution.
From the outside world.
That is the ideological core of their entire existence. They applied this extreme, almost religious purity test to their capital. They believed that any transaction, any marriage, any interaction with the outside world, no matter how
it was a risk,
it introduced potential risk, potential loss, or a potential dilution of that foundational wealth. It's a fascinating and, frankly, insane philosophical stance that preservation can only be achieved through total stasis.
But the mechanism they chose to ensure this preservation, as you mentioned earlier, is what takes this story from just, you know, simple greed to outright pathology and horror.
It's the how.
It's the how. If the external world, the town, the outsiders, if they were the source of impurity, then all necessary interaction had to happen internally.
Precisely. To prevent any fragmentation of the wealth or any contamination of the bloodline that carried the name, they engaged in systematic intermarriage.
And the documents are explicit about this.
Oh, they are. They list the unions that became the rule, not the exception. We're talking brothers with cousins, uncles with nieces. This wasn't a series of unfortunate accidents or exceptions.
No, this was policy.
It was foundational policy. It was generational law, all designed to keep both the name and the capital circulating in this perfect, horrifying, closed loop.
I have to pause here because this detail is, for me, the most profound and unsettling irony of this entire deep dive.
Mm.
They were pursuing the purity of money, a clean, undivided, consolidated fortune, by enforcing biological impurity through inbreeding. This inversion of morality, it just suggests a complete collapse of conventional human values.
It does. And we have to analyze what this implies about the family's self-concept, about what they valued, the physical costs, the genetic damage, the inevitable decline in health and vigor. All of that was considered acceptable collateral damage.
Or maybe not even damage. Maybe a necessary sacrifice.
Or a necessary sacrifice, exactly. All in the service of financial and titular preservation. They essentially decided that the sanctity of their balance sheet outweighed the sanctity of the human body.
They traded biological integrity for economic certainty.
A terrible bargain.
If we look at this through a historical lens, I mean, you see parallels, right?
Mm.
In some European nobility, they would engage in close marriages to protect titles and land. But here, the motivation seems even more pure, ironically. It was just raw capital and the surname. That was it. And to manage and maintain that, it required this unprecedented level of physical isolation and social separation.
Which brings us back to the mansion. The sources describe them as living locked away within that formidable building. The physical architecture became the embodiment of their ideological rigidity.
They weren't just withdrawing. They were actively shielding themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the detail about the walls surrounding the estate are just chilling because it moves beyond mere security.
It's not about keeping intruders out.
No. The sources emphasize the walls were so high that not even the town's light could reach them. That's not a security feature. That is a manifesto. It's a statement of intent. It is an active erasure of the outside world, not just a barrier.
I agree completely. What does that denial of light represent? I mean, think about it. Light is connectivity. It's shared reality. It's warmth. It's the visibility of a community.
It's life.
It is. And by blocking out the light, they were attempting to create this self-contained, cold universe where their rules and only their rules could possibly apply. This isolation was an accidental. It was a deliberate, generational withdrawal from society.
Because society,
its commerce, its people, its ideas, it all represented the ultimate threat to the purity they were so desperately trying to safeguard.
So if corruption came through contact, they built themselves a prison to prevent all contact. But what does that level of sustained isolation do to the people inside? Over generations, they were trying to freeze time and prevent change, but reality always finds a way in, doesn't it?
It does. By shutting out the external world, they created an environment where the only thing that could grow and fester was their own pathological obsession.
Like a petri dish.
Exactly. The wealth could only recycle itself, guaranteeing its perpetual existence, sure. But the inhabitants themselves, they became increasingly warped, increasingly removed from what we'd consider the human norm.
And that warping, that decay, that brings us directly into Act Two, the mechanism of decay. This is where the legend moves from, you know, sociology to straight-up body horror.
Yes.
We understand the goal. Pure wealth. Pure name. But the means they chose had these visible, undeniable consequences. Consequences which the town observed, however briefly, whenever any family member actually dared to cross the threshold.
And the townspeople, our local sources, they noted this change explicitly. They said that with each successive generation, the family grew richer. Yes, they became almost mythical in their wealth.
Right.
But simultaneously, they became stranger. And this is the first real receipt that their pact was working exactly as intended, but at this astronomical physical price.
So what specifically did the sources highlight about this decay? The documentation gives us three really distinct markers of their transformation.
The first were the physical manifestations. These were the easiest for the townspeople to note, especially in the rare instances the children were ever seen. They were born with different eyes.
Different eyes? What does that even mean? It's so vague and yet so terrifying.
It's symbolic, isn't it? It's not just about a genetic anomaly. Were they unusually wide? Were they mismatched in color? Were they strangely pale or maybe intensely dark and just focused?
The sources don't specify.
They don't specify the exact difference, but they emphasize the alien quality. These were eyes that looked out, but seemed to process the world through this filter of internal madness. They were already marked, visibly marked, by the unnatural inbred environment they were born into.
That image is so potent. Eyes that are different, eyes that maybe can't really connect. And think about the collective trauma of a family that looks at its newest member and sees the visible physical proof that their wealth strategy is literally damaging them.
And they continue.
And they continue the practice.
This slow, creeping transformation was just accepted as the unavoidable cost of doing business. But the changes weren't just visual. They affected how the family communicated, or maybe more accurately, how they failed to communicate.
Their voices.
They were noted to have this unique quality, described as if they seemed to whisper in dreams.
That phrase is incredible.
And the source describes it with this truly evocative, slightly terrifying phrase, dream whisper voices.
A voice that only whispers in dreams. I mean, that's an internal monologue made audible. It's not a sound that's intended for conventional conversation or negotiation or connection.
Yeah.
It's the sound of things hidden, of things that are slightly unreal. It suggests an inability, or maybe it's a refusal, to project their presence strongly into the shared real world.
Absolutely. That dream whisper quality signifies this profound retreat from conventional humanity. They weren't just speaking softly because they were shy.
No, this was something else.
Their voices carried the pathological weight of their deep pathological isolation. They existed in this perpetual state of half-reality. You could almost say they were already practicing for their lives as spectral shadows.
Wow. And what about the emotional cost? If they couldn't speak to the world, how did they regard the world?
Well, that brings us to the third and maybe the most defining emotional manifestation of this curse.
Which was?
The gaze that never learned to smile. This perpetual, unsettling lack of human connection, a cold, unsmiling existence, is the psychological receipt for the pact they made.
Smiling is such a fundamental social cue.
It's everything. It signals vulnerability, empathy, acceptance. By foregoing it, they completed their withdrawal from the social contract. They had no need for social currency.
Their currency was literal gold,
which demanded zero emotional investment. The unsmiling gaze was the final frozen testament to their self-made curse.
So we have this silent, whispering, unsmiling dynasty sitting behind walls that block out the sun, growing richer and stranger for generations. And then it all comes to a sudden catastrophic end.
Mm-hmm.
The timeline provides a very stark defining anchor for this. The mansion burned one silent night.
And this is where the legend becomes truly inexplicable. Because fire is violent. Fire is loud.
Yeah.
It crackles. It roars. It consumes. It shatters glass. It causes beams to crash down. Yet the primary observation that is repeated across multiple local accounts was the profound, unsettling silence of the event.
Okay, I need to push on that because that just contradicts all known physics of a structure fire, especially one that's consuming a huge mansion. Did the police sources have any explanation for the silence? Was it, I don't know, a massive natural gas explosion that somehow muffled the sound?
Mm.
Or did the local sources just immediately jump to the supernatural?
The initial reports really struggled with this paradox, and the legend, of course, quickly embraced the supernatural explanation. But let's just look at possible controlled explanations for a second.
Okay.
If the fire was a deliberate act, a final chosen erasure, it may have been initiated in a way that was designed to be quiet, maybe using slow-burning chemicals or some kind of containment method that allowed for the building to be consumed internally before the outer walls ever gave way.
That would imply a deeply controlled, almost ceremonial destruction. But even then, you would expect panic screams, right? Or at least the noise of the structure failing.
That's why the secondary detail here is so critical. because the silence was, for a moment, horrifically broken. Crucially, locals reported hearing brief moments of laughter being carried over the high walls during the blaze, and then immediately afterward, nothing. The silence returned, but now it was this pregnant, terrifying silence.
Laughter. Laughter amidst utter destruction. Okay, so if they were trapped, laughter signifies the final, total breakdown of sanity, a hysterical response to inevitable doom.
That's one interpretation.
But if they weren't trapped and the fire was controlled, what does that laughter signify?
This is where the source material really pushes us toward an interpretation of triumph, not terror. If we assume the family, in their deep pathology, saw the fire as the final necessary act to ensure their purity and their erasure,
then the laughter is celebration.
The laughter suggests a perverse success. They were laughing because they succeeded in their ultimate mission. They vanished without any external contamination. They preferred absolute destruction to dilution by the outside world.
They succeeded in achieving a perfect, clean erasure.
Absolutely. And the outcome was definitive. No one came out. No survivors were ever seen escaping. No desperate calls for help were ever heard. They just walked into the flames, or perhaps they became the flames, willingly. The silence that followed was total and enduring.
And when the authorities finally arrived to investigate this silent cataclysm, the police investigation offered the truly uncanny receipts that cemented this whole legend. They found no bodies. A family of ultra-wealthy individuals who had meticulously managed every single aspect of their lives for generations had simply vanished, leaving zero physical proof of their demise.
This absence is the ultimate evidence of their successful self-erasure. No human remains, no signs of a struggle, no evidence of escape. It's a clean slate, literally. Their entire generational existence had been reduced to ashes and emptiness.
And the only things left.
The only remnants of their entire dynasty, the only material anchors left in the physical world, were old family portraits.
And the description of these portraits is where the story truly shifts into the metaphysical. The sources are so precise and so disturbing. The faces in the paintings were deformed. They looked nothing like simple, formal portraits should.
Yes, the portraits weren't just, you know, smoky or damaged by the heat of the fire. They had deformed faces, as if the generational curse hadn't just affected the flesh of the family members, but had somehow imprinted itself onto the very canvases, onto the representations of their identity.
And this is the line, the crucial line from the eyewitness reports.
It was as if the paintings themselves had tried to escape the curse.
That is a massive leap. If they were just deformed because of fire damage, that's one thing. But to say the paintings tried to escape implies an active, sentient horror. What specific details about the portraits made the sources describe them that way? Did the painted faces appear smeared or distorted, or maybe even perpetually screaming?
The interpretation from the sources is that the deformation wasn't simple warping from heat. They suggest the deformation mimicked the genetic decay of the family members themselves, the strange eyes, the unnerving stillness, but it was intensified, as if seen through a lens of pure horror.
So the art was reflecting the reality.
More than that, the idea that the paintings were trying to escape means the inanimate objects were perceived as having consciousness, as suffering under the weight of this pathological fixation. The sheer density of the family's obsession was seen as contagious, capable of corrupting the oil and the canvas.
So the corruption wasn't just genetic. It was spiritual. It was an external energetic force. And when the physical bodies vanished in the fire, the corruption didn't die with them.
It latched onto the nearest available representation, the art.
The portraits.
Exactly. The portraits stand as the physical evidence of a spiritual cataclysm. A terrifying receipt of their failure to contain the curse within their own bodies. The canvas, the paint, the very frame, it was all perceived as seeking freedom from the suffocating, destructive need to preserve this wealth at all costs. It's the ultimate visual metaphor for a family that allowed an idea, the fortune, to devour its physical hosts.
So we have a generational self-destruction, a silent ceremonial fire, and a complete physical erasure confirmed by police leaving behind only these distorted, suffering pieces of art. This brings us into Act 3, the stakes and the enduring guard. For the people of Juana and for us analyzing this legend, what does this ongoing horror tell us about the pursuit of ultimate control?
It reveals the ultimate horrific price of self-imposed purity. The deep dive really shows that the commitment to the fortune and the bloodline became fundamentally more important than the physical reality of life or happiness or sanity.
The idea became more important than the people.
And the vanishing, the no bodies, the triumphant laughter, it all points to a voluntary erasure, where the family essentially chose to disappear entirely rather than allow any external impurity to touch their wealth. They sacrificed their very existence for the continuity of their fortune's idea.
It's a terrifying thought that the ultimate victory for their obsession was their total disappearance.
They valued the preservation of the concept of their wealth more than the preservation of their own lives.
And as with all great legends of great wealth and terrible unfinished deeds, the obsession didn't just die in the fire. The legend ensures that the family, or what they became, persist. Locals still swear by this haunting phenomenon years later, which demonstrates that the terror hasn't dissipated with the decades.
So let's talk about the mechanics of the haunting. The conditions are very precise, which I think lends a certain credibility to the persistent fear in the town. It manifests specifically on nights of a full moon. That detail is fascinating because it links the haunting into these ancient, predictable cycles. Remember, the family built walls so high the town's light couldn't reach them. The full moon represents a cyclical, predictable return of their influence.
A different kind of light.
A different kind of light. When the sun's light is replaced by a more ancient, indifferent light, the moon, it provides just enough light to illuminate the ruins, but not enough to dissipate the shadows. It's their perfect environment.
And the manifestations themselves, they're not the typical silent, mournful ghosts that are seeking peace or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about shadows. Shadows that are seen walking through the ruins. They are active, physical presences, observed in motion, performing some kind of duty.
They're not passive spectral residue. They are active entities. They are observed in motion, patrolling, covering the ground within the boundaries of their ruined mansion. They're still maintaining a vigil.
But the truly distinctive, spine-tingling detail, and the one that connects directly back to their life, is their activity. They are not silent specters, merely reliving a moment in time. They are talking among themselves. The whispers that were noted in life, those dream whisper voices, they continue in their haunting existence.
That talking is the most profound indication of their eternal entrapment. They are still engaging in the same internal monologue that defined their lives. They are still isolated, still talking only to themselves, even in death.
The conversation never ended.
It reinforces the eternal nature of their curse. They are trapped in the very isolation they so meticulously constructed, unable to reach out, only able to mutter quietly among the few remnants of their own bloodline.
It's the sound of eternal business, eternally unfinished. And the town has a very clear understanding of their intent.
No, absolutely. They behave as if they were still guarding their fortune.
Even though it's gone?
That's the key. Even as shadows, they are performing the singular duty that defined them in life. They are guarding the idea of the fortune. The gold is gone, the mansion is ruined, the bodies vanished, but the pathological commitment remains. This reflects the town's collective belief and its fear that such concentrated power and that level of pathological obsession never truly dies or dissipates.
And I think that connects back so beautifully to the idea of the walls blocking out the light. They built a fortress against the light and the sound of the outside world. And now, in death, they are eternally trapped within that self-made darkness, repeating the same internal silent monologue they began in life. They are their own eternal prison guards.
It's the ultimate consequence of their desire for absolute control. They achieved a kind of permanence, but the permanence is defined by the very qualities that destroyed them. Isolation, silence, and this perpetual, unsmiling vigilance. They didn't just become ghosts. They became a functional, spectral security system for a fortune that no longer exists.
That's the ultimate legacy of the Wanna Mansion, then. A wealth so great it demanded the erasure of the family and life, only to transform them into this permanent, watchful presence tethered to dust and shadow.
And the final distillation of this story is critical for you, the learner, because it really challenges the notion that tragedy always stems from external forces. The key takeaway from our deep dive into the silent fire and the shadow guards is this. Sometimes the curse isn't in the land, it's in the family that refuses to let go.
Their tragedy was entirely self-inflicted.
Completely. A result of prioritizing gold over biological reality and basic human connection.
And that leaves us with a truly provocative thought to consider long after this deep dive concludes. If the family's greatest, most consuming fear was losing their fortune and their name, did they, in some strange, terrible way, succeed?
How so?
By vanishing so perfectly, without a trace, and transforming themselves into this indelible, permanent local legend, known forever as the Shadow Guards of Wanna. They achieved a kind of immortal notoriety that no living, breathing, connected family ever could.
Their fortune vanished, but their story is eternal. It suggests that erasure, when it's complete enough, can paradoxically achieve the kind of permanence that true, messy human life could never guarantee. They exchanged a temporary existence for a perpetual legend.
If you want to review the full timeline of the sources for the story of the Wanna Mansion, including the analysis of those deformed portraits and the eyewitness accounts regarding the Dream Whisper voices, you can find all the receipts at Inspector Story.